Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags. I've got 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers, leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Thursday, the 8th of August. Coming up on the programme, the police minister and his new crime-fighting strategy. The last chief executive of British Airways, Comair, and his views on the collapse of the carrier. Is the gender pay gap in South Africa showing any signs of improving? Rising levels of news disinformation in South Africa and reviewing Team SA's Paris Olympics performance. The new police minister, Senzo Mtunu, says he will clamp down on rising levels of crime, saying that the leading crimes in the country are contact crimes such as murder and rape, as well as hijacking and kidnappings for ransom payments. He joins us on the program now. Minister, welcome and thank you very much indeed. And firstly, in your opinion, is crime firmly under control in this country?
Not really firm under control. But I would also say not exactly out of control. What then do we mean? Practically, South Africa, when you go to the streets and so on, you do see order, you do see police, you do feel that people know that there are laws and so on. But then while you are observing that, you will see that there are people who are taking chances in that order that you see, in the presence of police, but use gaps where police are not seen or visible. And you will see people pouncing on unsuspecting communities, either at night or on the street while people are just doing daily businesses and so on. They take chances and they pounce on them, either as individuals or as gangs, but mostly as gangs. And this is on the increase, both in communities, that is what would have been low-profile crimes or petty crimes. It is now becoming gang-driven crimes, to bigger crimes like cash in transits, like drug cartels and syndicates. And of course, that lead to murders. So, not out of control in the sense that whoever is a criminal, they know when I do all these things of my criminality, police might appear. I must be fast and disappear. They might come anytime, but not exactly under control in the sense that there are those gaps. This is what we are seeing out there.
So, Minister, what assurances then can you give to the business community that you are now dealing with this speedily and efficiently?
It's good that you talking to business. I've met a number of business organizations individually coming up to me. Some of them, one of the business group flew from Johannesburg to Cape Town just to meet me. I'm glad that they are fed up on this, on their own, on crime, just the rate of crime. They are not just fed up, but they are prepared to stand up and do something, and they regard South Africa as their home. All they want is government to meet them, whether halfway or quarter way, and they want to see government standing up and fighting crime, not only on behalf of business, but on behalf of community individuals and their families. But what is crowning on all of this is that they are prepared to do something. Now, in the next few weeks, and months, we are going to be outlining a model on how we could work with business, but already now on the ground, but at another level. A business organization has approached president, and there's a forum which is chaired by the president himself, and that forum, as a matter of fact, will be meeting next Tuesday. It has got a number of streams on fighting crime. And so we're fine at that level, but you need to get down as quickly as possible and implement whatever flows from those discussions in those forums. Because while it is helpful and very important, it doesn't cover all the angles of GAP to a point where it can replace South African police services' own kind of street fighting physically with a presence together with the crime intelligence. But even crime intelligence, you may plan, you may finance that, but it needs the will and it needs enthusiasm and it needs a highly disciplined and sharpened approach, because these people are modern and they're using technology and all of that. So
Minister, let me ask you then, what is your immediate call to the business community ahead of these meetings?
Yeah, there are two things. Firstly, to make business aware that as much as possible, we would want them to speak out against crime. We would want them to come forward on their ideas of how we can fight crime. We also want them to put word out there that we are seeing kidnappings of particular individuals, especially of who are foreigners. And I hope that this is all of them legal foreigners who are in business and so on. If they could put word out there that they need to look after themselves to the best of their ability and so on while we fight. But in the main, we are saying we are getting organized with municipalities, especially those with Metropolis. We are getting organized provinces, and we are going to be descending to the ground and fight crime to the best that we can. But I just want to close by saying there are three things that are linking up now. One is drugs. Now, drugs are going hand in hand with guns and hand in hand with murders. Now, these three, and not very far from them, there are foreigners who are deeply involved either physically in these drugs and murders or in the supply chain of these drugs in one way or the other, at some geographical area or the other. But there is presence of a foreign character of drugs. Now, we are getting ready to confront all these categories that I'm talking about, but this is quite apparent in the character of crime that has surged in South Africa. It's drugs, it's guns, it's murders, and then the foreign character in all of this. And that's where we are at the moment.
Right. Minister, thank you very much for talking to me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. Now, Glenn Osmond is the former chief executive officer of the now defunct British Airways Comair carrier and has just written a book about his part in the demise. It's called Crash and Burn. He joined me a little earlier and I asked him first about his sometimes testy relationship with pilots.
No, I have a high regard for airline pilots, particularly when you're flying and the weather is bad and it's raining and that they need to land late at night. Then I have extremely high regard for pilots. I probably don't have as high regard for the pilot trade unions, but for pilots as individuals and their flying ability, I have high regard for them.
But sometimes, as you say in the book, that can be a little bit difficult, right?
Yeah, look, it's an age-old battle. You know, pilots generally, you're flying Joburg to Cape Town, you work for probably 10, 15 minutes, you sit back, you drink a cup of coffee, and you engage in your favorite topic, which is normally, you know, this would be a great airline if only it wasn't for management. So that's sort of, you know, what the view is generally from pilots of management. But if I look at my run-ins for pilots, it's never been personal. It's really just been about... you know, it needs to be the right headcount, the right productivity. And what the problem at Comair was, compared to our competitors, our productivity was probably 40-50% of SAFE, our main competitor, yet our staff costs were 30-40% higher than theirs. So it was something that needed to be fixed, and it's something that we faced head on, and it's something that we fixed.
In fact, Glenn, you say right at the very beginning of the book, I've always viewed an airline as an accounting problem that needs to be solved rather than any type of glamorous boys and their toys adventure. But it is a very difficult industry to be in, and the margins are razor thin, are they not?
Exactly right. It's extremely capital intensive. You know, aircraft aren't cheap at all, so it swallows up a huge amount of capital. The margins are really tight. I'd say as a rule, it's seldom that an airline earns more than, say, probably 7-10% as a margin, and they work very hard for that margin. And you know, there's always the risk of extraneous factors, particularly in South Africa, where, you know, there's always the risk of exchange rate shocks. There might be trade union activity, there might be oil price spikes. So the margins are tight, and it is a high-risk business. So it's really is key that you have an income statement solution for the airline, which generally is just low operating costs, lower than your competitors. Always have a pile of cash so that when things start going bad or things going wrong, you're always the last man standing. And avoid excessive debt, you know. So it's really those three things that are fundamental for an income statement solution for the I wouldn't say for only one airline, for airlines in general. And you know, particularly in South Africa, because we only earn rands here, yet these aircraft are all valued and priced in US dollars. So it's extremely tough to earn rands and to pay off huge US dollar debt.
And how difficult is it to manage those costs? There's the famous story that I think we've all heard about, I think Southwest Airlines in the United States of America, where they might have removed all the olives or the peanuts or something, and they saved a huge amount of money over a year-long period.
Yeah, I've heard several versions of that story, but it's exactly right. You know, if you're flying 4 million passengers a year, and if you can just save 100 rand in terms of operating costs, you know, that's like, let me just get my maths right. It's about 400 million rand that you'd be saving. So it's extremely sensitive to the variable costs. You know, it's the same as fuel. You know, fuel increased $5, that would hit us with probably like 100 million rand as an extra cost. So it's extremely sensitive to the shocks on pricing, on fuel, load factors and so forth.
So, Glenn, your entry into the airline business was with Bop Air. I do remember them well. And you write about this being a business built on a culture of service. What does that mean? And do you think in the modern aviation idiom, we might have lost that?
It's exactly right. You know, the important ingredients are service and price. So it needs customer service. And, you know, if you look at the airlines that succeed, that's generally because of the customer service and the price. So the price needs to be right. If the price is the same at a few airlines, you'll always select the one that offered, you know, exceptional standards of customer service, which is really a problem in the market right now. You know, we have a single carrier, SAFE. I think they've got 60-65% of the market. So that whole ethos of how important customer service is, it's not really there because, you know, we fly SAFE because we have no choice sort of thing. So it's not at the levels it was several years ago.
Well, the book is called Crash and Burn, A CEO's Crazy Adventures in the South African Airline Industry. Glenn Osmond, one final question. Chicken or beef when you're on a flight?
perhaps I'd say pass.
All right. Going to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us, the publisher, Jonathan Ball. Glenn, appreciate talking to you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, ahead of Women's Day tomorrow, new numbers show that one-third of working women lack retirement saving and face the dual pressures of the gender pay gap as well as unpaid labour. Sharon Mietzi is Senior Advisor, National Debt Advisors, and joins us on the programme now. Welcome to you. What then are the primary reasons behind this?
I would say first thing is like lower earnings. As we know that as women, we earn less than men. And then that results in reduced savings potential. Career interruption is one of the reasons as well, because we are more likely to take time off for caregiving. That reduces earning potential and retirement savings as well. increase our reliance on debt, on others, sorry, because we rely more on our partners, family members, sometimes on grants for financial support. That is actually not enough to cover for our retirement savings.
So is that figure then of one third static, or is it getting worse?
I think it's getting worse. That is really getting worse. As you know, that as women, we are more than men, and then we are more expected to take care of our families. We rely on that small amount that we get. We have to make sure that we cover for everything. And then even being a single parent as well. It also forms part of us not being able to save for like our retirement savings.
So how can women then, in your opinion, overcome the financial hurdles posed by these dual roles that you've outlined for me, both in the workplace and at the home? Is there a better strategy that they can adopt?
I would say yes, there is a better strategy that we can adjust. First of all, we have to make sure that we focus on us before we do anything. We make sure that we save enough, though sometimes it's hard. Make sure that you budget lower cost. Make sure that you have everything that you do has to be in a lower cost so that it can accumulate what you have. Doing that, it will help you in the long run. Save as much as you can, even if it's 100, 200, as much as you're saving, because you have to think for the long run. You don't have to think for the short term.
But I would also suggest to you that with stubbornly high inflation at the moment, saving for all people has become that much more difficult. So theoretically, it works, but practically, that's not always possible, is it?
Yes, but as much as it's hard to do something, sometimes you have to sacrifice some things to achieve things that you know that this will benefit me for a longer run. You understand?
I do understand. So does National Debt Advisors then have a new way of thinking on how people should approach saving?
So we can assist with debt review, assist people who are over indebted, because once you go under the program, at least you will be saving that amount that you didn't have before. And you'll also be, I would say, rehabilitated. No more debts, try to manage what you have and try to save as much as you can. And I know that, yes, we survive with debts, but sometimes you need to make sure that I want to make sure that I achieve this goal. To achieve this goal, I need to rehabilitate myself.
It does take a little bit of courage sometimes to face that reality, though, and say, I am prepared to go into debt review.
Yes, yes. And it's not an easy decision to take. You just need to sit down and think of the longer run, think of the future before you take that decision.
But often if you are wanting to take that decision, there's a stigma attached to it, and people also have pride, don't they?
Yes, because most you'll find those clients that will like, will you call my workplace? Are you going to call my friends? Do you need to speak to my wife? And most of the time, married couples, they don't want to even include their spouses. So that's where the problem comes. But if you tell yourself that I need assistance, I need to be financially free, I need to make sure that in future my family, my spouse is sorted out, even if it happens that I'm no longer alive, I need to make sure that I take this step.
Sharon, I would also suggest to you that probably the biggest problem here is the lack of financial literacy, particularly among women, and their ability to manage money and debt within that cohort that you have identified for me. How do you improve that level, do you think?
Budget. That's the most important thing. Budget. Before you do anything, sit down, budget. Make sure that whatever you put on the budget is something that you know that this will benefit me. And comparing prices as well, as you mentioned, that inflation, things are a bit expensive, but there are those shops that have lesser. So make sure that you also compare prices before you take any decision.
Do you think there are better ways that women can negotiate increased pay and pursue more ambitious career goals? And again, we are having this conversation ahead of Women's Day tomorrow.
Yes. Okay. So that's a very good question. But to be honest, like you said, that sometimes it's even hard to just say, I want to take this decision. You know that as women, most of the time, you're the ones who are in care of the household. So sometimes you need to prioritize what's important. know that this is important, this is a need, and this is a want. I can live without this, I can live without that. It's not easy, but it's something that it can be achievable.
Often, you're right, it comes down to very stark choices when one is making a purchasing decision. And what about financial institutions and employers? In what way can they, if at all, contribute to reducing the financial pressures faced by women, as you've outlined to me?
In that department, to be honest, I don't have a clear answer on that. But what I can say, according to my own knowledge, is that those financial institutions, they're also there for the business. They don't even want to use the word care. They only want to make sure that they make money on themselves. What I can say for women is make sure that whatever decision that you make is the right decision, and it will benefit you for longer run.
Well, some good advice there ahead of Women's Day tomorrow. Sharon Mietze, thank you very much indeed. Senior Advisor at National Debt Advisors. I do appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
With around 19 African countries holding elections this year, there are worries about mis- or disinformation. And to that end, I'm in conversation now with Anna Collard from the No B4 Africa, an NGO that has conducted a survey on political disinformation and misinformation across five African countries: Botswana, Kenya, Mauritius, Nigeria, and South Africa. Anna joins me on the program now. And why then do you think we're seeing a rise in this fake information?
So, I mean, there's a couple of reasons. In fact, I mean, if you look at some of the findings that were reported by the Africa Research Center, they've actually documented that in Africa or on the continent, disinformation, so that's the intentional spread of false information. So there's like an objective behind it. It's not just, you know, people sharing something for fun with no malicious intent. That disinformation has quadrupled in the last 2 years. And the actors behind it are, in 60% of the cases, those are foreign nations. And the Russians, they write on top, the Russians are behind 19 of the disinformation campaigns that the Africa Center has documented, and probably even more so. So it's really driven by, you know, let's call it nation states that have agendas to drive polarization, to create social unrest and chaos in order to, you know, like then create allegiances with Russia and these governments to come in as like the helper in the emergency sort of thing.
Anna, have you applied your mind to what makes Facebook and TikTok particularly susceptible to the spread of mis-dis or information or fake news?
Oh, man. You know, I mean, it's terrible. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, you're a journalist, right? And you know, when you work in reputable journalism, that you have to follow certain ethical standards and gateways before you publish anything, right? Now, the problem with social media is that anyone nowadays can be a journalist, and anyone is allowed to say what they want and spread what they want without any sort of consideration to the verity of the information or the damage that they might cause. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, and I have to, as much as I used to be a fan of him years ago, Elon Musk, but now I just, you know, this person and Twitter or X at the moment, they are behind spreading disinformation that suits their political agenda. I mean, case in point is this whole riots that has been going on in the UK,
right,
where Facebook actually was quite responsive in taking down some of the malicious disinformation that was spread. But X didn't. They've actually rocket-fueled those pieces of content, with Elon Musk even commenting in support of this right-wing. I can't use bad words on media, but you know what I mean. Like, you've got social media platform providers that have, in X's case, that have, let's call it just a controversial individual behind it with their own agendas, driving content that is unfortunately very powerful in its manipulative features.
Mm. Anna, in your opinion, how significant is the threat of disinformation in this country compared to our neighbors?
Well, I think South Africa is no exception. The World Economic Forum has actually, they bring out a report that identifies the top risks for the next 2 years. And disinformation, misinformation is right on top. It's the number one risk that they see that's, you know, the world is facing, even before climate change. So it is a massive risk, particularly, you know, South Africa, you've seen it, you know, with the elections going on, there were campaigns trying to sort of, you know, disqualify the election process. There were disinformation campaigns trying to make a Zuma's presidency sound better than it really was. I think we've got another 19 countries on the continent that are going through elections this year. I know Mauritius and I think it's Nigeria, they in October and November. So I don't see that South Africa is in any form different necessarily to the rest of the African countries. What we do have, obviously, is the ANC and its, you know, allegiances to Russia in the past. And that's also been behind some of these campaigns.
Again, within the South African or the African idiom, how do you think governments and social media platforms then need to collaborate more effectively to address the issue that you've raised?
Yeah, so first of all, they have to understand that it is an issue and take responsibility. We need to do way more on public awareness, like really driving. And I mean, in all fairness, you know, there have been great initiatives in South Africa, particularly during the elections, to do that. You know, there's been a couple of pages or websites that you can go to and verify whether, for example, a political advert was really, you know, what it claimed to be. But I think much more needs to be done. And also the governments or the regulators need to hold the social media platforms responsible. You know, they're obviously just there to drive up their advertising profits, and they get more advertising profit if they get more traction. And disinformation, unfortunately, because it's emotive, people are 7 times more likely to share false news on Twitter or any of these platforms. It's in their favor in some, you know, unfortunately, as bad as it sounds,
yeah.
It's in their favor because it results in more traffic.
Yeah.
But they need to be held responsible.
7 times more likely. That is a worrying figure. Anna Collard, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
And finally on our program today, as the Paris Olympics draws to a close, I guess it's time to reflect on performance and maybe what needs to change in the Olympic setup as far as South Africa is concerned. Daniel Motowagai is City Press Deputy Sports Editor and is with me now. Daniel, first of all, on a positive note, what, in your opinion, were the standout performances?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and good afternoon to the listeners. I think the obvious highlight would be Tatiana Smith coming back with 2 medals. It's the real reason why we're still up somewhere up there in the top 40 on the medal table. So definitely a highlight from our team.
And on the flip side, was there anybody that fell short of their potential this year?
Absolutely, Jeremy. You look at, obviously, we had high expectation on Wade. And, surely we couldn't even really consider the fact that the man had is still coming back from, you know, that long-term injury that kept him almost for 3 years. I think he's still on the road to recovery, basically, even though he had completed, you know, the official rehabilitation and stuff. But, you know, it was expected of him, to really deliver better than what he did at the Games. And, of course, our legendary swimmer, Chad Littlaw, as well, sort of disappointed in his specialist 100 butterfly.
We ran an interesting poll on this program about whether there is sufficient corporate and government support for Team SA as far as the Olympics is concerned. Do you have a view on that?
Yes, I do have strong views. I mean, Jeremy, look at look it from the medal table point of view. You look at the USA, China, Australia, even the host France. I'm talking about the countries that are in the top 10 currently. You look at the size of the teams that they always take to the Olympics. What it says is that it shows you that there is some sort of investment in their sport for the fact that they are able to afford to take such big teams compared to, like, for instance, you know, with the USA team, their track and field team alone, the athletics team, is the size of our entire team in Paris, which our team, which is competing like in about 21 sports. So it really now takes us back to bodies like SASCOC, you know, to really put the money where the money where their mouth is, and then to really look at our strong points, where I think athletics and swimming have traditionally proved to be the sports that really bring us medal at the Olympics. I mean, also you take, for instance, this new sports at the Olympics. You look at the this hip hop culture in South Africa. Why not also sort of bring in sports like skateboard, break dancing? I think we've got many youngsters who can really go and do well. And I'm talking about this because when you speak of low-hanging fruits, these are the kind of medals that we can easily get there. You know, like South Africa is so talented in many things, and the only thing that we need is for people to really invest where we do have those talents, and, you know, get something out of it every time we go to events like the Olympics. Mm.
And just very quickly, aside from the financial investment, as we now start to look forward 4 years to Los Angeles, are there any other big things that the Olympic structure needs to focus on in this country?
Yeah, sure. I mean, for instance, Jeremy, we all know that we've always been dependent on the National Lotteries Commission, you know, for that big portion of the grants and stuff. Unfortunately, you know, with corruption that has been ongoing in South Africa, that money didn't really go to the right structure. So I think from that perspective, I think as the government, like for instance, the Minister of Sports, they must holistically look at the allocation of funds to really make, sports to be where it used to be in South Africa. Remember, now and then these politicians, they will tell you how sports is the unifier in the country, but how much are they investing in it? It's another question. They don't really, you know, sort of walk the talk. I think it's about time for them to really sit down and then do these allocations correctly and sort of put sport out there. Otherwise, I mean, if our athletes are doing well, that will be sort of the motivation that the country needs. I mean, we've seen what the victory of Bafana in AFCON did, how the Penny Haynes, the Josiah Tuhanis coming back with gold medals did to this country. So I think it's about time that we go into that deep introspection and sort of do the right thing for sport in this country.
I really appreciate that excellent analysis. Thank you so much, Daniel Motuwagai, City Press's Deputy Sports Editor. That does bring our program to a close. Just before I go, on our last online poll, I referenced the Total Energy's gas exploration departure. I asked if the sector was compromised, if it could have been avoided, or if our energy security is broadly threatened. And over 50% of our respondents say it did not need to come to this. And today, leading on from our interview with the police minister, do you believe that South Africa has crime firmly under control? Yes, no, or efforts are underway. If you have a view, and I'm absolutely sure that you do, please go to our X or our LinkedIn page and put your vote down. That's also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. We are back on Monday. Have a good long weekend. Thank you for listening. And goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.